This episode is brought to you in part by Brew Guru, the free mobile app that helps you save money on beer and homebrewing supplies. Find Brew Guru in your preferred app store and follow the path to good beer. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 10th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, author and historian Maureen Ogle returns to talk about her revised book, Ambitious Brew, A History of American Beer. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com. And we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already seen the video episode featuring an update on my Brett Golden Ale that had Brettanomyces added at bottling 6 months ago. I'm planning to release that to the general public on Friday. And Steve and I are set to get together this evening as I record this to shoot at least two more video episodes and the next top sampler. So we're busy bringing new stuff to y'all, and financial contributors get to see early releases and behind-the-scenes stuff that the general public doesn't have access to. Two of the beers that we're going to talk about this evening have something to do with Wyoming. You may remember Aaron Mayer from Pine Bluffs Distilling sent me some bourbon and some Vienna malt from Wyoming Malting Company. I brewed a 2-gallon extract stout and added some bourbon into that, and I brewed a smash kolsch with the Vienna. Both darn tasty beers, in my opinion. So I'm looking forward to sharing those with Steve and seeing what he thinks. Speaking of darn tasty beers, let's talk a little bit about our friends and sponsors up at Tavor. Tavor is a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered to you. It's not a beer of the month club where someone randomly chooses a beer for you. You only pay for the beer that you choose over the course of the month. Signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at Tavor.com. That's T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com. And download their iPhone or Android app. You'll receive notifications for two new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes from Philip at Tavor. This month, Megan up at Tavor says, look for selections from Superstition Meadery, 903 Brewers, Garvey's Point, Crane Brewing, Elder Pine, and Ursula. If you're not interested in the beers that you see, no worries. Just skip the ones that you don't want. However, when you do see something that you do want, and you will, don't wait. Just click on it and add it to your crate. Your beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing you enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping. So why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase anything. In fact, if I can ask you a favor, go to Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or download the app. And when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, that's all one word, and you'll get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. Again, it's free to sign up. There's no obligation to purchase. Sign up at Tavor.com or with the Tavor app and enter Basic Brewing as the promo code. And thanks very much to the folks up at Tavor for sponsoring the show and supporting us. I finally got to go to Little Rock to do interviews at a couple of breweries in that area. Finally, I spent the weekend with friends in Hot Springs, and on the way down, we stopped at Lost 40 in Little Rock. That's the estate's largest production brewery. You may remember Grant Chandler from Lost 40 came up to Northwest Arkansas a couple of years ago and shared some amazing beers with us in the back of Steve's brew shop. It was great to visit with Grant again down at his place this time, where he's now the quality manager. And we tasted some Lost 40 staple beers that I've had before because they're distributed. And we also had a couple of beers that are only available there locally. Grant fermented with wild yeast that he harvested locally and domesticated. So that was a great conversation. Then on the way home from Hot Springs, we stopped in Little Rock again at Rebel Kettle, which is a brew pub that's about a block away from Lost 40. And I had a great conversation with John Lee at Rebel Kettle, who makes he takes inspiration from breweries like Dogfish Head. John likes to play around with ingredients and styles to come up with sort of off-the-wall beers that are both tasty and drinkable. But at the same time, he's got some really solid examples of traditional styles on tap. And so you'll hear those interviews coming in the next couple of weeks. It's finally getting cooler here in Northwest Arkansas, and that means brewing season is upon us, finally. If you haven't done so already, it's your time to upgrade your old propane system to an awesome electric setup from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. High Gravity has been building electric systems for over a decade. I've got one of their Warthog 240-volt brew-in-a-bag systems, and I love it. You see it on Basic Brewing Video. No more worrying about running out of propane. No more losing heat in the mash. No more missing my strike temperatures. Brewing with a Warthog controller is a pleasure. And at highgravitybrew.com, you can see systems from other manufacturers, too, like Blickman Engineering. From 5 gallons to 2 barrels, whether it's a single, dual, or three-vessel system, highgravitybrew.com has what you want and need. Take the pain out of propane this brewing season and use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, way back in 2006, Maureen Ogle appeared on this program to talk about her brand new book at that time, Ambitious Brew. In that book, she told a story of American beer that was not based on, you know, hearsay and myth and such, but on historical research that she conducted herself. She dispelled a lot of the myths about American beer in that book. Well, now she's back with a revised edition that she's published herself. Maureen Ogle, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm genuinely appreciative.
As am I. It's been a lucky 13 years since we originally got together to talk about this book. And I had such a fun time talking to you then that it turned into two 50-minute shows, which, you know, was a record up to that point, and I don't think it's been repeated.
I remember that very distinctly, and for the people who are now listening 13 years later, I'll just say that is still, in 13 years, the best interview I've had with anybody. And I've written another book. I've done hundreds of interviews since then and written a completely different book, and the guy knows what he's doing, so to his radio gig.
Of course, this puts me in the precarious position. I should just drop the mic and walk off and end the conversation because you can't get better than that.
No, audience would hate you. But I remember how long it was. We just started talking and we talked a long time that day. I think my phone finally ran out of batteries or something.
Well, after we record this, I've reread the book. And I'm going to go back and listen to those interviews after this. And the key to doing a good interview is finding someone who knows what they're talking about and just let them talk.
James, you better hang up right now.
All right. Well, now that we've gotten the false modesty and mutual backslapping out of the way. Yes. the book is Ambitious Brew, The Story of American Beer. And you are re-releasing it? What did you do to it?
What I did to it, this part of this is the arcana of publishing, which is, frankly, one of the most disgusting businesses in the world. I got the rights back to the books, both the meat book and the beer book. I now own those books. I didn't own them before. A publisher did. But now I do. So I revised the book. I didn't add new content. I didn't change the argument, but I cleared out some fluff and I reorganized two chapters so they would read better. I think the new version, it just simply reads better. And I changed the subtitle because I had no input on the title of the original book. But so the title now is Ambitious Brew, a history instead of the story, a history of American beer. So it's a gently revised, it's shorter because I just cut out crap that I could, 13 years later, I could see. I'm like, why did I put that there in the first place? So it's a gently revised version, which I now own the rights to. And thanks to the technology that's now available for people to publish stuff. First of all, it was just amazing to do this. 13 years ago, it just wasn't possible to do this at all. Now it is. The rights never went past North America, but the rights that the publisher owned, which now belong to me. So the book is available anywhere there's an Amazon store worldwide, Amazon Germany, Holland, UK, Japan, wherever, as a digital book and as a paperback. And so far, it's also available on Kobo, which is a Canadian outfit, I think, and Barnes & Noble. But again, I published this book. It has a much better cover, I might add, much better than it had before. So it's a gently revised and I think more focused version of the original book. I think it's better. And honestly, the 13 years kind of got past me. When I decided to get the rights back, I thought, man, there are probably, the beer world has changed a lot in 13 years. There are probably a lot of people who don't even know that book exists. So that's what I did.
Yeah, I got the title wrong because I've got the hardcover, the original hardcover in front of me, but I did purchase and download the ebook version, you know, the Kindle version, and I did read that. So, so just for the ease of, you know, it's easier to have something the paper still in front of you, you know, to thumb through and look
right.
through.
Right.
But yeah, if you haven't read the book, you need to purchase the book in whatever way you can get it, and you know you'll be supporting the author.
That's right.
Which
I get
important
money this time.
Yeah.
Yes. And I will also say, even a couple of years ago, trying to read a work of nonfiction as an ebook was a dicey proposition because of the business with endnotes. I'm a historian, for the people who are listening who don't know that. I'm a historian, so everything is documented. And man, it is so cool now because you can just, if you're reading on a Kindle or a phone or whatever, you just tap that note, it opens. And when you're finished reading that note, you just tap anywhere on the screen and it closes up. It is the coolest thing in the world.
Multimedia. That's
cool. Stuff like this just was really not feasible until very, very recently. It's amazing.
Well, I reread it over the weekend, and it's a fun read. And I've forgotten, you know, over 13 years, I forgot a bunch of stuff in it. So even if you've read it 13 years ago, you need to pick up a fresh copy and read it again. Because there are stories in there, like, you know, and I don't want you to tell the story, but the story of Lily Bush coming back to Key West and what she went through down there. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
How could I forget that? But I did.
And the Pabst Blue Ribbon story and, you know, lots of stuff. I sort of forgot myself. Yeah.
Well, for those who haven't read it, it's kind of, It dispels a lot of the mythology of what we thought we knew about American beer. I mean, you know, starting from the American colonists, you know, and the American founders of the country, they were beer people, and you know, Sam Adams and all the, you know, they are all beer people, and our nation was founded on beer, and all this. You start by knocking that one down.
Yeah, that's it's not that people. Well, they did drink beer, but beer, as I'm sure most of the people who are listening to this know, making beer requires a fair amount of effort and it needs materials. And it's frankly easier if you're looking for alcohol to make spirits, to make, say, brandy or rum, because you can get more bang for your buck. So during the colonial period, there simply weren't enough people around to really make it feasible to build anything out build out a commercial brewing industry. So yes, people did make beer at home. There's no doubt about that. I'm not disputing that. But the national beverage, well, it wasn't national because it was the colonies, but the colonial drink of choice was rum, period, end of story, because it was dirt cheap. It was really cheap, and there was gobs of stuff to make it from. So, Sam Adams, I'm sure, drank beer once in a while, but there weren't any little breweries around. And if you stopped in your local tavern, if there was beer, it was around. It was simply because the owner of the tavern happened to have made some recently. But beer, as anybody listening also knows, doesn't keep particularly well, whereas spirits will keep forever. So this was definitely not a nation founded on beer. That is for sure.
The effort in the acreage to grow grain was better put into using that grain for bread than beer, probably.
Eventually to feed livestock, because then the grain could be walked to market. But even if you tried to ship the grain, say, to a brewer in, I don't know, Boston or somewhere, much of the grain would be lost en route because it would either rot or rats would get into it. So alcohol just traveled better and was far more stable. So brewing, people made beer, people drank beer. And beer was imported from Europe for people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. They could afford to buy casks of stout or whatever, sent over from England. But in general, beer was a bit hit or miss for a very long time.
And it was German immigrants who came to American heartland that you credit for really putting, nailing down the start of the American beer culture.
Yes, in the 1840s, for a lot of reasons, many people who spoke German in Europe wanted out because there was chronic warfare and it had been going on for decades. And the people who wanted out came to what was by then, of course, the United States, and they did want beer because beer was deeply embedded in their way of life. And so was, weirdly, a kind of sobriety. Americans, by the time the revolution ended, Americans had basically shifted from rum to whiskey, because again, grain was more profitable to grow and turn into alcohol than it was to try to ship to market. So Americans, I'm afraid, had a very sick alcohol culture by the 1840s when these Germans showed up, and they said, well, enough of this nonsense. We're going to make beer because that's what they drink. And because there were so many of them, they were able to build networks of importers to get hops, for example, because there was very little hop culture, if any, in the United States at that point. So they began cobbling together a replication of old world German beer culture in the United States. And that's really when a commercial, stable beer culture and beer industry began to take shape in the 1840s and 1850s, which is roughly when the book opens. I do look back at the woes of the colonial period, but in effect, I start in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the 1840s with a guy named Philip Best, who founded what 50 years later was known as Pabst Brewing Company and was by then the biggest brewery in the world. So this change happened very quickly, but it was absolutely because of German immigrants.
And the first wave of anti-drinking or prohibition sentiment in the country came, you call it a sick beer or sick alcohol culture. Beer it seemed to be sort of the alternative. You said that people were saying that beer was not intoxicating.
That's right. That to me is, and I'd kind of forgotten the strangeness of it until I revised the book and just republished it. But because Americans drank so much hard liquor, I mean, imagine a drinking culture where pretty much that's it, and everyone drinks all day long. Constantly. Public intoxication was, in fact, a serious problem, especially because the United States was also in the process of becoming an urban nation. So you had tens of thousands, and in a few cases, a million or so people crammed into relatively small places. And public intoxication was absolutely normal. So in the 1830s and 1840s, especially, Americans began retreating from this national curse of alcoholism. And by 1850, a number of states were trying to, and one actually succeeded in passing statewide prohibition. And many towns and counties began banning alcohol use within the confines of their, you know, their political borders. And for a number of reasons, which are outlined in the book, that had to do with the enslavement of human beings and a nation teetering on civil war, Americans were trying to figure out where's the middle ground here. Prohibition is very intrusive. It really drives deep at the heart of what it means to be an American. And in the 1850s, Americans truly resisted the idea of imposing an outright ban on alcohol, but they really wanted people to stop drinking so much hard liquor. And lager beer, which is what the Germans brought with them specifically, lager beer, became an alternative. The German immigrants who came here were not universally, but typically were relatively what we would call middle class. They weren't like the impoverished Irish who were fleeing famine at the very same time. The Germans built businesses. They built entire towns. They contributed in a significant way to the American economy, and beer was central to who they were. And Americans who weren't German said, well, here's an example of a culture that has alcohol at its heart, and yet these people are prospering. They're not drunk all the time. And so lager beer ended up being kind of a test case for how to fit alcohol into a nation that had serious doubts about the wisdom of drinking. And in the 1850s, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of court cases in towns and cities that actually asked the question, is lager beer intoxicating? And the general answer at the time was, no, it's not. And so lager beer became socially and politically acceptable, which in retrospect seems absolutely nuts, but that's what happened.
And it's kind of ironic that, and we're just skimming the surface of the content here, yeah. Or otherwise we'd be here for 2 or 3 hours this time. Absolutely. But it's kind of ironic that in part because the breweries were so competitive and so ambitious and, you know, wanted growth at all costs, that they were pretty much the one of the causes of the second and successful wave of prohibition.
That is exactly right. That's exactly right. In the 1850s, lager was everybody's new best friend. But by the 1890s, American cities had grown at a rate, had proliferated in number in a way that Americans were having a hard time managing. That was also the same time, again, this is now 50 years after that Americans were first building a big industrial economy. And the result was that the millions of immigrants who were coming in were working in factories in, frankly, rather brutal conditions. Back then, a workday was 12 hours long and the work week was 6 days. Mm. And making mostly terrible wages in brutal conditions. And workers, men and women alike, sought relief in the comfort of a saloon. They didn't have room enough at home. Many of them lived in, you know, 5 or 6 people crammed into maybe a 500 square foot space. And saloon culture proliferated. And it was fed in part by the brewers themselves. The brewers needed outlets for their beer. And saloons were the places where beer was sold. So in the 1890s, there was yet another reaction, this time aimed specifically at the brewers and the saloons. The main thing saloons sold was beer. And so beer came under attack. And initially, brewers responded by lowering the alcohol content, lowering the alcohol content, just keeping on lowering it. And yet middle class reformers said, nah, we really need to just eliminate saloons and alcohol altogether. And so, yeah, inadvertently, the very thing that made lager socially respectable got turned upside down 50 years later and ended up leading to prohibition. Go figure.
And it didn't help the brewers that, you know, there was anti-German sentiment due to World War I. And so, you know, they were further vilified because of their, you know, cultural heritage.
That's right. That's right. We always think, I think most Americans who know anything about Prohibition think it began in January 1920 or whatever, 20 or 21. I can never remember. Don't ask me why. But it didn't. By 1910, 10 years earlier, half of Americans were already living under some sort of prohibition, either state prohibition or municipal prohibition. And brewers were, their numbers got cut. Brewers weren't, they were being forced out of business. So the number of brewers shrunk significantly. And when World War I started, the people who favored prohibition, who were, I just have to say, the original godmother, godfather of all lobbying groups in the United States, they really had a brilliant legislative strategy for shoving prohibition down Americans' throats. They immediately latched on to the war. First, they persuaded Congress and the president to simply not allow brewers access to any brewing materials. Then Woodrow Wilson ordered them to make beer with no more than 2.75% alcohol. And then it just got banned altogether. So, and a lot of it was couched in terms of the brewers, American brewers, people who had been born in the United States, as German patriots who were actually treasonous and probably spying on Americans. It's a very, very ugly chapter in American history, truly ugly.
And thank goodness we never did that again.
Oh, if only we could say that. Yeah, it was the ugliest, but it was, I was, when I wrote the book, I remember how shocked I was because I like to write books I don't know anything about. So I didn't know anything about this. And I was just stunned at how brutal the attack was on brewers. And again, by that time, these people were American citizens. We're talking the second or third generation of brewery owners. You know, they were not Germans at all. And did the fact that their grandfathers were really came back to haunt them.
And but one good thing about Prohibition.
Do tell.
Is that our favorite topic here on this show, homebrewing, yes, came into favor.
Yes. And I wish somebody would write a history of homebrewing because it's a fascinating topic. It is true that when Prohibition started, the reality is that when Prohibition was in effect during those 13 years, anybody who wanted booze could get it. The other reality was that most Americans didn't want it. There is no denying that the prohibitionists persuaded well more than a majority of Americans that alcohol was evil. But everybody else who wanted alcohol could find it. So alcohol was shipped in from Canada, for example. And yes, you could go to a grocery store and buy ingredients to make beer. And the boxes of, for example, yeast would say, this will not make an alcoholic product. But, you know, it's not, no offense to all you homebrewers, but it's not rocket science, right? So that's in fact, a great deal of homebrewing, yes. People were making beer at home. There's no doubt about that. And in big cities, especially New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, there were lots of members of what we now call the mob, racketeers, bootleggers, who were using empty warehouses and so forth to make what I gather was just nauseatingly bad beer. It's called alley brew.
But let's skip forward a bit. We get out of prohibition, and you know the prohibition has weakened the brewing industry considerably, and it's left all but just a few standing afterwards, and they kind of take advantage of that.
That's right. There were not very many left, and probably not even 100 by the time legal beer came back in April of 1933, and then the 21st Amendment was repealed in December, not repealed, ratified in December of 1933. So legal booze came back in 1933, but there were not very many brewers, and they all struggled to survive, partly because the racketeers who'd been making alley brew had no intentions of going away. So for several years after 1933, legal brewers just couldn't compete price-wise with the racketeers. But the bigger problem was Americans just weren't interested in beer. People who'd lived through Prohibition and mostly drank alcohol, hard liquor rather than beer. And it was incredibly difficult for brewers to keep their doors open from 1933 on. One of the big myths about the history of beer in America is that somehow these rapacious brewers, meaning Anheuser-Busch, Pabst, Schlitz, came along and just ran everybody out of business. But it's a lot more complicated than that. It was just incredibly difficult for a brewery to make a living given the complete lack of interest that Americans had. If they were going to drink, they wanted hard liquor, but most of them, again, just weren't going to drink. People who were adults in the early 1930s had grown up in a world, in effect, where there was no alcohol. And people just don't change their social attitudes and customs overnight. So it was a very difficult business. Add in the Great Depression and the fact that there were, for example, barley shortages and things like that. It was a hell of a way to make a living. It was hard.
And Americans' tastes were changing where the beer got blander, not because it was cheaper to make or easier to make or whatever to do it that way. But you say it's because Americans' tastes were going that way.
That's right. That's right. There's clear documentation that from the 1920s on, Americans' palates simply changed. Cigarettes, for example, that's an example I use in the book. The tobacco in the cigarettes was far less harsh than it had been before. In the early 1950s, vodka became popular in the U.S. for the first time because it doesn't have any flavor. It's just basic booze with no flavor. Americans didn't want beer that had flavor. And again, there's plenty of proof to this. I'm not making this up. Breweries that wouldn't adjust their recipes just couldn't sell their beer. Someone has said to me, many people have said, well, what about Ballantine? Ballantine was still popular in the East Coast. That's right. Beer tastes have always been regional. So there was on the urban East Coast still a large enough critical mass to support somebody like Ballantine for a couple of decades. But out in, say, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, those were one of the driest places in the country. And the kind of beer that people wanted in that very arid climate was a light, drinkable beer. And that is why the Coors family stayed in business and did very well after the end of Prohibition. You really, if you make beer now, you've got to give the market what they want. You can't drive the market. Anybody who makes beer today knows that.
Yeah, people complain about there being too many IPAs on tap nowadays, but until people stop drinking IPAs, there's going to be IPAs on tap.
That's right. And I think if you interviewed any small beer maker, of which there are now like 7,000, which just boggles my brain, they'll tell you it is not easy to keep pace with consumers, affluent consumers who are used to getting what they want. And what consumers in this country want is novelty. They just want constant novelty. That is the curse of an affluent society. When you're not worried about feeding yourself, when you have money to blow, you want to blow it on stuff that appeals to you. And we just have an insatiable appetite for the new and the novel. So Beer making is a difficult business, and that was especially true in the 1950s and 60s. It was what saved brewers, honestly, was the fact that the baby boomers, of which I'm one, hit legal drinking age right around, I guess, 1959 or 60. And so all of a sudden, there was a whole bunch of people who had not grown up with prohibition and who could legally drink. And that is the one thing that kept some small brewers in particular going during the 60s and 70s. Without them, they would have shut their doors.
And again, we're skipping like a stone across the...
We are. Go read the book. You can get all the fine details.
Yeah, you need to read the book. But in the 70s is when, again, home brewing comes to the rescue.
Yes.
And starts, or is a part of, starting up the revitalization of, American beer taste buds.
That's right. In fact, I would even push it a decade earlier when I interviewed a guy named Michael Lewis for this book. He's retired now, but he was for many, many years the guy who taught brewing science at the University of California at Davis, and many people who are now brewers studied under him. And when he was first hired in the 60s, right off the bat, he started getting phone calls from people in California, a lot of them hippies, but a lot of them people who had traveled abroad and had developed a taste for a different kind of beer, wanting to know how to homebrew. And so he actually started offering extension courses in the 60s because there was a demand for it. And in the 70s, the combination of, again, affluence, which meant that Americans were traveling in record numbers abroad, especially to Europe and England, and the presence of baby boomers, especially people who were at the time called hippies, the counterculture, there was an incredible resurgence in home brewing, which is why I wish someone, besides, because I'm not going to do it, somebody would write a history of that, because it's genuinely interesting. There was a lot happening from about 1964 on. It was pretty surprising.
And the roots of the craft beer movement in the United States, the two of the guys that planted the seeds, or maybe I guess there'd be three guys, maybe. Fritz Maytag, who took a nearly bankrupt Anchor Brewing Company and turned it into a tastemaker. Our friend and mutual acquaintance, Jack McAuliffe, yes, with New Albion, who built a brewery from scratch out of scraps. And then Charlie Papazian, those three were would you say they were the most influential?
Yes, I would. And the anomaly in that group is, of course, Fritz Maytag, who I've known Fritz now for, I don't know, about 10 years. And he, at heart, he is kind of a romantic. And he was a young man living in San Francisco, and he did not have a goal in life. He did not have a purpose in life yet. It was the late 1960s. And all around him, people were getting on the freak bus with Ken Kesey and dropping acid, which was the last thing in the world Fritz Maytag wanted to do. He was looking for something he could do. And someone told him about Anchor. And he went and took a look. And what appealed to him, part of it was saving a bit of local history, because the brewery had been around at that time for, I don't know, 80 years maybe. But the other thing was he was a science nut. And what appealed to him was the idea of making beer. When I interviewed him for the book, he said, I'd always had a microscope. I sort of got the science of this. So he bought this small brewery and put it on its feet and made it profitable. And his genius lay in the fact that he looked around San Francisco and noticed that affluent young people, again, this is 1964, so baby boomers are now legal drinking age. He noticed that they were drinking imports, and he thought, well, how about I give people a beer that's novel, but very well made, and sort of package it as this special thing? And it worked. I mean, it was a long time before he made a profit, and he worked his butt off to get to that point. But that was his that was his take on it. He loved the science and the idea of making beer. He loved the heritage, and he understood how to work the consumer market, which to me is pretty important. And so Jack and Charlie are more, they're the two that are more like each other than Fritz is, because Jack, well, again, Jack was not quite a baby boomer. He's a little bit older than Matt. I think he was born in 1942, I think. So he's not quite a baby boomer. But when he was 18, he joined the Navy and shipped out. And he was stationed in Scotland, and he went crazy for the beer. And Jack, as you know, is an engineering genius. There's simply nothing the guy can't figure out how to do. His job in the Navy was to do maintenance on nuclear submarines, for crying out loud. So he came back to the U.S. and said, you know what? He didn't know what to do either. He didn't really want to work in an office, because that's not Jack's thing. And he found a bunch of scrap materials. He went to talk to Michael Lewis at UC Davis, and he built himself a brewery. His didn't succeed because Jack's a bit, what would you say, eccentric? He's a bit eccentric.
Well, he's a really smart engineer. And if you know smart engineers, there may be a certain personality that fits into.
That's right. I love the guy, but he's, and at the time, you know, nobody was going to give him money. He had a beard. You know, he lived on a loft above this ramshackle warehouse where he built this brewery out of scrap parts. He couldn't get money from anybody. So he went under. And Charlie Papazian also had a form of genius in that I'm assuming the people listening know who Charlie is. He was just flat out into home brewing. And his thing was community. He loved the way beer brought people together. Plus, he liked making it. He was interested in the science, but I've always said that people who make beer, they're either into the science or they're into kind of the cooking art part, but you rarely find them mixed together. And Charlie he loved the community, and he loved making beer. You know, it was a good vibe out there in the Colorado foothills, but he has a serious entrepreneurial bone in his body, and he decided this was how he was going to make his living. And as you noted earlier, by the 70s, there was a lot of interest in home brewing, and Charlie decided to tap into that. He saw it in Boulder, where he lived and still does, and he decided to found the American Home Brewers Association. And then when the microbrewers, as they were originally called, now I don't know what they're called. They're not really craft, whatever they are now. When they came along, he, more by accident than intention, became the, no, it was more intentional. It was more, he was the guy who pulled these two groups together and gave the new microbrewers a home, a place they could call home, because Anheuser-Busch was certainly not, you know, standing there with open arms to welcome them.
Well, nowadays they are kind of.
Yes, nowadays they definitely
open wallets. There.
Yeah. But in the 1970s, they had zero interest. And Charlie totally gets credit for. I always say Charlie is the kind of guy who sees what's around the corner before the rest of us even know the corner is coming, and he just zeroed in on the energy around beer, and he collected it unto himself and turned it into a viable industry, and total credit to him for having done that.
So I want to fast forward again before we run out of time, but I want to take your pulse on what's good. Well, first of all, you are working on another book.
Yes, I am.
So we want to talk about that before we move on.
Yes, I was going to write after my last book, not the beer book, but one after that about the history of meat, which sort of ruined my life momentarily. I decided I was never going to write another book, but I thought, well, I want to write something, so I was just going to write like maybe a 25 or 30,000 word essay about beer from 1978 to roughly 2015. with my take as a historian who at that point had been an onlooker to the industry for quite a few years. And that little project to a full-blown book that will focus on small beer makers. The kind of hook of the book is going to be August Shell Brewing Company in New Ulm, Minnesota, which is the second oldest brewery in the U.S., but it's also been owned by the same family since 1860. There's never been another owner. It's just that family. And they were not the only ones. They're the last survivor. But until the 1980s, there were a bunch of those. And I was curious about how did a small beer maker actually survive? And I also think that Papazian's creation owes more than he realizes, or I had realized, he owes more to that long legacy of small beer makers who, you know, managed to keep themselves going without becoming Anheuser-Busch or without being demolished by Anheuser-Busch. So that's what the new book is about.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. And that's about a year out.
Yes, I believe that in about a year, and I'm going to publish that. I am from here on out, I'm doing my own publishing. So I've written a gigantic chunk of it. What's been killing me is wading through German language newspapers in the late 19th century. That's because the New Ulm, I don't know if your listeners know much about New Ulm, but it was founded by a bunch of those German immigrants that we were talking about. And they founded it specifically because they were fed up with Americans and their prohibitionist attitudes. They wanted to just live a German lifestyle. And so the brewery was founded there. Family still owns it. They've lived there ever since. And I forgot where I was going that point, but I guess it doesn't really. I've been reading these German newspapers and using Google Translate. And you know, the research is pretty time consuming. It took 5 years to write the first book. So, but I've written a whole bunch of this, and at least I know what the heck I'm doing this time. So yes, I expect in a year or so, I'm hoping in about a year, because frankly, no one would be happier to see me publish it than me, honestly.
Well, I want to take your historian hat off, and then put your analyst hat on. What do you make of what's going on today? I mean, we've got this huge number of small, from small to regional to national breweries.
Yes.
Now. And you got Anheuser-Busch and InBev and all these people that are buying each other up and buying the little guys up. And man, it's turbulent.
It's turbulent. And it's also the whole thing rests on a foundation of a stable, flourishing economy. It assumes millions of people with lots of disposable income. Although I think when the economy finally collapses, many of them will go out of business. The other thing about today's business that I find most interesting is the intentions of the owners of these breweries. Some breweries, like I'm going to use Vinnie and Natalie Chilurzo, who own Russian River. I'm going to use them as an example. They just flat out don't want to get big. Mm-hmm. Vinnie has always said, I just want to be able to ride my bike to work in the morning and come home and sit down with my wife at night and eat dinner. And that is their business model. A lot of these 7,000 people really just, they don't want to be Anheuser-Busch. But then there's a whole bunch of people, like, I can't remember her name now, the co-founder of Golden Road. Her intention from the get-go was, I've got a master's degree in business. I know how to start a business. This is a viable industry. I'm going to build it, and then I'm going to sell it. So the 7,000 breweries is, to me, a weird mix of intentions. And I think that people don't quite get that part. And I think definitely people don't understand how much the stability of the current brewing industry rests on this economy that we're now in we're about 25 years into a very stable economy. We've had ups and downs. We've had, the recession. You and I were actually together in Denver the day the stock market collapsed in 2008. I remember it clearly. But it's interesting, but I don't know. I don't get too bent out of shape about it. I think if you're going to open a brewery, you better make damn sure before you do that you know what your intentions are. Do you want to just make beer because you like making beer and hang out with your friends? Because if you do, you're not going to last long, but go for it. Do you want to build a business that's going to feed your family for the next 20 years? Then keep your eye on that ball rather than trying to sell your beer everywhere. There's an interesting case. I've totally forgotten now the name of this brewery in Iowa. I just read an article about 2 days ago, which shows you how well my brain works. Distributors had been approaching this small brewery in Iowa, and the brewery owner said, look, I love that you're calling me from Portland, Oregon, but that's really not what I want to do. I'm not interested in being the next big thing nationally, the next big beer darling. So we're in a very interesting time. In my wildest dreams, back in 2006, when the book first came out, I never would have imagined 7,000 breweries. It also poses interesting questions for the Brewers Association, which is the trade group for craft brewing, because the more they urge people to open businesses, the more they're going to have a membership that maybe doesn't quite fit their founding mission, which is okay. But it's I don't know. Check back with me in 5 years and we'll see where we are. I don't think 7,000 breweries is particularly sustainable myself, but.
Well, I kind of, and I've used this analogy 1,000 times on the show, but I kind of look at breweries sort of the way I look at the restaurant industry. I mean, you've got everything from food trucks to, you know, citywide chains to regional chains to national chains.
Yeah.
And it's all in what you, if you're happy doing a food truck and you can, and it's sustainable and it feeds your family and it's doing, you know, you're doing what you want. Well, that's okay.
That's right. There is no shame in that.
But you mentioned, you know, the Brewers Association and you know, they, I don't know what, where the definition is now, but they used to have to change the definition of what a craft brewery is every year because Sam Adams kept getting bigger and bigger. And now Sam Adams has bought, Dogfish Head. So
That's right. Yeah. I don't know. And I don't know. I think there's no shame in building a business that feeds your family, man. That is the greatest thing in the world. And most businesses in the United States are in fact small family businesses. I don't, you know, we get kind of obsessed about the power of corporations, but statistically, most businesses are small ventures, and that's great. And as long as you can appeal to the people who live in your town and you know you've got enough people to keep you going, go for it. Just as Mitch Steele famously said several years ago at the CBC, just don't f up the beer. Because if you do that, you're going to go out of business. So, it's an interesting time to be a beer drinker. I guess I didn't mention one of the real biggies that's driving this growth, and that is the generation that didn't directly succeed baby boomers, but because I think that was Generation Y, which was very small. But the millennial generation is even bigger than the baby boom generation. And when they start to age out of the drinking age, well, just make sure you've got your business plan in order because you may not survive that.
Just purchase lots of stock in the people who make sparkling seltzer water, sparkling seltzer water.
I tried some of that a couple of weeks. I finally broke down and said, okay, I'll just try it. And I couldn't finish a can. I cannot figure out what the point of it is. I honestly don't really want to get, I don't know. I just don't get what the point of it is. It's just sort of a buzzy, it's kind of like having a joint almost. It's sort of buzzy, but you know, I don't know. But man, that's the other thing that I think is interesting about beer. What exactly is beer these days? And if you're a beer maker, do you just make beer or do you make seltzer? Do you make mead? You know, it's an interesting time to be observing the beer business.
Well, there you go. Maybe that's where we should leave it.
So, because, yeah, that's as far as my analytical abilities go.
Well, another 50 minutes has gone in the blink of an eye.
Oh my God, it has. Good Lord. Yes.
See, I tell you, you know, I just asked what, four questions during that whole time.
No,
and so
no, you asked more.
You make my job easy.
Oh, well, thank you. I do the kind of work that requires me to be by myself all the time. So when someone actually wants to talk to me, I got plenty to say. Just don't get me started on politics.
And with that, oh, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate the excuse to get together with you, and I look forward to next time.
Yes, and I don't think we've actually seen each other in person for a couple of years, so I'm looking forward to that, too. I don't know when that will happen, but someday.
There you go. Thanks, Maureen.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks again to Maureen. Ambitious Brew is a fascinating read. Be sure to pick up the newly revised edition with the new title, Ambitious Brew, A History of American Beer. Pick up the new title so that Maureen can be compensated properly for her work. And I look forward to her new book, as always. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.